Hello, and welcome to our series, Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources professional in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Ford Keast LLP, and I work with my clients to help them with the HR side of their business. We hope that you will enjoy these discussions with real people about real challenges and real working life situations. Welcome. My guest today is Salome Azevedo. Welcome, Salome.
Hello, Jen. Welcome. Thank you for receiving me in this conversation.
It is wonderful to have you here. And we have a variety of things we're going to be chatting about, including I'd like to talk about English not being your first language. Let's chat about that for a couple of minutes, about your academic background and about your work background. And we'll talk about career resilience in terms of fitting in the job. So those are our plans for our discussion today. But first of all, where actually are you in the world right now?
Lisbon, Portugal.
You're in Lisbon, Portugal. Mm-hmm. And I'm in London, Ontario, Canada, where if I look out the window, there is just snow everywhere. So if you look out the window, what do you see?
It's a perfect sunny day today. So been raining and raining for the last 2 months. And these last 2 days, the sun has come out and it's beautiful. So I think everyone is very happy in the last 2 months.
It's a little chilly here. So I wanted to talk about, where did you pick up your English?
Okay, so in Portugal, since we are, I think, 9 or 10 years old, we start learning English officially at school, so in a public school. But my parents wanted for me to have an advanced learning in English, so getting to get to know more about the language and use it, because they thought that back in the time, so we were talking about in the 90s, now it would be, English was going to be the first language in the world. So they just wanted for me to go deeper on the language. And when I was 12 or 13, I started going for the Cambridge courses that are, I don't know if you are aware of it, but in countries that don't speak English, they have this kind of courses and you do it in your extra time after school. So I started there. Mm-hmm. And then they also gave me the opportunity to go for 2 times in the summer to do summer schools in the UK. Mm-hmm. So one near London to have the experience of how to live in the UK. And that, it was like summer schools, like between 2 weeks to 1 month, something like that. So the experience was basically very triggered by my parents, and then because we consume the American TV and all the culture that reaches Portugal is well depth on English, everything then was basic on movies and series. Everything is translated to Portuguese subtitles, so you get to get into the culture easier. Yes. Compared to Spain maybe or to France. In here you start listening in the national television in English very, very soon.
Okay, I wanted to ask you, does it take bravery to use another language, or it's just no big deal to you whether you're speaking Portuguese or English?
It depends on the topic. So in my work, everything that I produce, it must be in English. So you get to be almost the first when you think you are already thinking in English, you know. But when you start talking about yourself or what you like to do, or in the personal life, Portuguese becomes first. And then when you have to be in like this kind of format with you, mm-hmm. or getting to know each other, Portuguese or the expressions or the sometimes you want to make a point, Portuguese, I think it's brave when you try to do it in English. But it's not, it's, it can be tough for you to express some feelings that you have, but I think it's good because it's kind of an effort to show the others that you want to communicate with them.
I have to say that I think it's very brave, but I do think that sometimes, Salome, it's a cultural difference because over here, maybe because the landmass is so huge, we speak English, and of course we speak French because we're in Canada. But mm-hmm. the trouble is that sometimes we're not brave enough to speak in the other language. And I think that that's different in Europe because the landmass is so near, you're near everybody. So all these different languages and so on. That's what seems to have been my take on it. So let's switch over to your academic background. So tell me about your education.
I always loved sciences. I really enjoy arts. It's one of my interests, but I never wanted to pursue it as work. So I was like to do it for free.
Yes.
And it's something that amazes me and makes me dream. But to work, I always thought about more like in engineering or even medicine. So I was looking for the scientific part already. And I was very triggered by my father. So my father is a civil engineer. And he always pushed me a lot in trying to see the world as an engineer, even if he doesn't say it. But it was true since I was a kid. He was always trying, like, let's try to destroy this and come up with a solution for that. And so my mother was not always happy when we tried to ensemble or the objects that we had in our place. But I always liked to see him working and the way that he thought about the project. So I thought, I think I won that very early in my life. So it was really easy to decide that I wanted to go to engineering back in high school. But I was not so sure about which kind of engineering because I really loved sports. I've always done sports all my life, so I wanted to kind of match engineering with sports, but it was really strange, the idea. And my father was searching for course universities for me, and he found out like biomedical engineer must be the thing for you because it's going to mix technology with healthcare, and you love technology. I always love technology and how to work. How does it work, and how can I apply it, and how can I make it better? So you also like sports, and they are coming up with a new professional career that will touch in all these things. And I'm very optimistic. That's a thing that now I'm trying to be more realistic, because it's good to be optimistic, but not being enough realistic can make you can put you in trouble. So I start dreaming a lot about the like, this is going to be amazing, you know, engineering, getting into healthcare, trying to improve the human body. I thought about like more scientific fiction than what it actually is. So when I started the course, the biomedical engineering here in Lisbon at Tecnico, I had one expectation that was completely different from the reality. Mm-hmm. And it was like another stage of my life.
Are you a very competitive person, Salome?
Yeah, very. I don't believe it's not in a bad way. I always played team sports, so it was always to make the team win. I never competed individually, and I'm not very good at competing individually. Also, I get a lot of pressure, and I start questioning myself because I always had the support of the team to go for it. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm a competitor. I like to do it, and it must be good. So,
okay. So let's switch over to work then. What do you do for a living?
So now I'm the head of digital health at Vocal Lab, which is Value for Health Co-Lab. It's a new kind of organization that the European Union is supporting to get highly specialized people to work for both academia and industry. So trying to accelerate knowledge transfer between academics and the industry to develop solutions faster and with the new mechanisms so that actually the industry can innovate faster, can apply solutions to the society. So this organization started 2 years ago. And we are in the first period of evaluation to see if everything is going to work. They will let the organization grow. And my focus is, I'm the responsible of the team that is actually designing new services for healthcare digitally. So imagine, I think it's easier to get to a point. There are to get a real case. Patients that were submitted to a cardiothoracic surgery that are in the hospital, they should be, it would be safer for them to recover at home because they would not be risking a new infection and so on. But most of the time they don't go because the physicians cannot control all the symptoms that they have. Mm-hmm. So what we came up with a solution last year that we are still testing and seeing if everything works really well under real world conditions is to give a small kit of devices to the patients. They're very simple. It's like a scale, blood pressure unit, a thermometer, and that's all thing. Yes, and an app, so a mobile app. And they go home earlier and they can stay at home recovering, but they have to measure every day two or three times their vital signs, and the doctor receives everything. So if something happens, something changes drastically, they go to the hospital faster, and it's better because they feel safer at home than in the hospital. They are more comfortable, they are with their family.
Okay, so is the big thing about that, Salome, that the vitals are provided to the doctor through the app?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes.
It's not just the person alone saying, oh, well, that looks okay, or I think that's okay.
No.
It's tracked. Okay, that's a huge innovation, isn't it? So you're bridging academia and business.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, what is that like? Because I see those as two very different worlds.
Yeah, completely. It can be really exciting and can be really frustrating depending on the day and depending on the people, because the problem is that you are dealing with people, regardless the world that they come from. They it's people, and when you have proactive people, very interesting in getting into a point of a solution, you don't see you just see the difference in the way they think, but they are engaged to the project.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem when joining these two kind of worlds is when they have prejudice against each other already. You know, it's like they have already some preconcepts about the other, and they start the meeting already not trying to collaborate. I think I was lucky to meet very good people on both sides and see that you can reach that point.
Mm-hmm.
You have to change their way of thinking, changing culture also. But it's interesting, you see, because academics, they're moved by publishing articles and their scientific credibility, and yes, everything has to be really rigorous. And it's a lot of work trying to come up with methods and pursue work that is very rigorous. On the other side, in the industry, they have to do it, everything, as better as they can, but in the less time possible.
Yes.
Because they bring pressure from other kind of triggers. Mm-hmm. So when you have different indicators of their success, that's when they collapse, because one is all their lives they had time, mm-hmm, and they don't have, and they want rigors, and the other also they want quality, but they don't not need to be very rigorous about it. So
Which world are you more comfortable in?
So it also depends, which I think it's the problem in here, because I'm not an academic as we look for professors that used to taught us on university, that all their lives were in their office conducting highly quality research and getting the resulting papers published in the best journals in the world. I'm more like a practical person. I like the both sides, the best side of both worlds, and it does. I cannot understand why it's not. Is it not that possible to do it? Because I like applied research, so it's like I want to do research to solve problems that are under scrutiny now. But I also understand that a lot of people in the world want to solve problems that will come up in a few years, that's how the science evolves to. So I would think that I don't belong to neither of the worlds, because I think I believe I'm from a generation that is trying to mix both worlds, and we are trying to come up with new games in it. Yeah. But I like more the academic side, because it you can think, and you can have time to think about it and to test. And in the industry, you are more restricted. You don't have that time, so it's difficult, and you have to make a lot of decisions very quickly, and take that responsibility. So I don't know. I would go for the academic, I think.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, in terms of resilience, I think you have a very challenging job, because you are bridging worlds here and doing such important work. For resilience, how do you deal with the stress of that?
Okay. I wish I knew, I think daily, it's because when you have goals in your head, it's easy to be resilient, because you know where you want to reach. I think when we start losing our hope is when we don't see the end point, the end game. How is it going to be? So when I start feeling that I might let it go and I'm going to give up, it's let's focus, let's sit down again. And what is the goal of the project? What am I going to do in the end? What is the outcome that I want to achieve? And when you stop for a minute and you do that, everything becomes again eager to fight again for, you know. But that's my strategy. Not doesn't work all the time, but as you are dealing with so much different people all the time, because also patients, right, and informal caregivers, we have to interact with them, and we have promised a solution for them, and it's no longer a published article, or it's no longer a sales on the other side. It's something. It's a solution for people. So usually what we do, and some of my colleagues say the same thing, is when we start seeing that a lot of people are trying to mess up with the project, is this is for the patients. So let's focus on the patients and make everything that we can for them. And that's also a good trigger for us, I think. It makes you go for it and keep going and keep being resilient.
Yeah, I like that idea of focusing on the goal and focusing on the patient, the individual. So that brings it down to human beings, right? And the goal of what are we really trying to achieve here, which I think from the choice that you've made in terms of your career makes total sense, doesn't it? It kind of all flows from when you and your father were tearing things apart and building them back up again.
You go to that bubble again, you know, it makes sense. So let's do it again and let's make it better.
Now, are you also getting your PhD?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So that's the problem of fitting in. I never wanted to go for a PhD, and never thought about it. I was like, I don't want to study all my life, and it was never on my mind. But when I started working in a beautiful project also, it's called Patient Innovation, and it was developing a platform, an online platform where patients could share solutions they have developed from all over the world, and I was the platform manager of the platform. And my boss was also a professor in a university, my two bosses, one in a business school and another in a medical school. And they were always like, you like to do research. You just don't know that that's research, but you are doing it. So you should go for a PhD. And I'm like, I'm not going to a PhD because I never wanted to do a PhD. So, but you'd like to do research. And if you like to do research in this world, you have to take a PhD. And it was a struggle that we fought a lot for 2 or 3 years. I remember they were like, please tell me you have to do it. You have to do it because you are very competitive and you're going to see people going in front of you because they have a PhD and you're not. And you're going to lose projects because you don't have it. So, and here in Portugal, there are not a lot of vacancies for professors or for researchers. Everything is very precarious in Portugal, in the academic life.
Okay.
So I never saw it as a goal because I knew it, how the probability to get a position in university was very low. So if you are not the A student of your class, you don't even think about it because it doesn't make sense. But things changed a lot in these last years, not because they opened new vacancies, because they started investing in trying to make people more specialized. So getting to have PhD and having the opportunity to work in the industry too. So you can still do research, but do work in industry. So you're not dependent on new job openings or in the job market of universities.
Yeah.
And that was why I decided to go for it. It was like, that makes more sense now. So
yeah.
I'm going to, it's something there. I can go for it. I like to do what I do. So let's go professional about it. And I started doing the PhD 2 years ago in engineering and management because I didn't see myself anymore just an engineer. I also like to see the bigger picture of all the solutions that we were designing or we were developing. And management was becoming really interesting for me in terms of strategy and healthcare as a system. So when I got deeper in the healthcare, I thought like, no, the problem is that we are just looking only for lenses, only for from one perspective. And the problem is that healthcare works as a system. So it has a lot of people inside that want different goals, that also have different benefits from the system. And you have, if you want to implement better healthcare or if you want to get new interventions to our people, you have to know how the system works. So what is the strategy? What is the game? And that's what I wanted to go for, the management. And
okay.
I went, it was really cool.
So you wanted to take a really holistic approach to the work and to your career.
In Portugal, we were on a crisis, a very strong crisis in 2008. So it was when we started going to university. We knew that the probability to have a job when we finished university, regardless if you were outstanding or not, would be very low. And you had to leave the country and go to work outside. So we always were very afraid of not getting a job when we finished university.
Mm.
So when we got one, everyone was like, give your best. You have to work really, really hard and you have to give extra hours, even if they don't pay you. And all this kind of mentality that was in our generation made us go for the week for to be the best because we could
yes.
lose our job like this. So I think because I have cousins that are younger than me and they don't think in the same way. They are not afraid about the same things that we were afraid like 6 years ago or 7 years
mm-hmm.
ago. So it's kind of interesting to see that what comes up in their heads. It's, you know, that company can give you like, they have very good offices, you know, it's like they have free time for the employees to play games in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And they have Friday nights, beer Friday nights. And they're looking for those kind of social relationships that that was not even in our mind to think about when we were looking for a company to work, you know, like they're looking for criteria that in my mind, I don't even understand, but it's that. It's like the experience that they can get from the company or from
mm-hmm.
the academic level.
Mm-hmm.
It's very funny and beautiful. I think it's better to look to look for that.
You think that's better?
Yeah, way better, because you're going to spend 8 hours of your day or 10 hours of your day in there. So if you're not looking for an experience, you're becoming a robot after a while. And I think they looking for the experience, I think it's better. It's, you look back and you see we have a progress in here. So it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think you would really enjoy that environment, given the driven person that you are?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I don't know, because I like to separate things. So when I'm having fun, I'm having fun, and when I'm working, but I like to have fun and work. So I would say yes, it depends on the mix. So if it becomes too party going, I wouldn't like. Mm-hmm. But to have the social part, I think it would be better.
Yeah.
Because you get to know other people and yeah, learn with them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I wanted to ask you, if somebody's thinking, listening to you, of taking their PhD, what would you say to them? What would your advice be?
Think twice, but not in the bad sense. It's a decision. It's an important decision to make, because it's a commitment to yourself, not to anyone. It's just a commitment to ourselves. The PhD only depends on me to finish. It only depends on me to be good at it. And it's a lonely career in the sense that you are your own boss in the PhD stage. So when the days become a little colder and you are just a little bit sad, there's not going to be anyone cheering you up and say, let's go do it, let's go for it, and it's going to be tough. No, it depends on you to wake up and say, I'm going to work on this, and it's going to be very good. And you have to be lunatic. I remember one professor telling me that you have to be very close to a math person, because you have to be always trying to see how much fun you will get if you go for that path. And in the end, just, you know that it's not going to be so funny at all, but you have to motivate yourself constantly and to see the best part of the world in everything you do. Otherwise, you're looking at that in desperation. You're not going to want to go for the end of it. You will give up. You will blame everyone except you that you couldn't do it. And it's tough. And if you are not, I was not mature when they asked me, when they told me to do the PhD for the first time. And I knew that because I was immature to the point that knew this was my outcome only. So if I don't go for that and know that I have to face it by myself, I'm going to be the one to suffer. And I hate to quit, to have that in my mind all the time, that I will quit would make me crazy. So for a person that would want to do a PhD, is to read a lot of experience from others. I did that. So I'd search for all the forums, Quora and Reddit. A lot of PhD students share their experiences online. And when I liked some kind of research, I would ask, what was the how was it? Everyone says it's tough, and it is, no problem. But if you really want to do it, you would split that in a lot of stages and share every conquer that you make and see it as a progress in yourself too, right? Because from 2 years ago, I'm a completely different person, not so stressed about it. If I cannot do it, I know, and it's not because I didn't try, it's because I couldn't do it. And I'm not mad at me because of that. And as a PhD student, you have to be really sure about it. So you're going to do a lot of things wrong, and you cannot blame yourself because you've done it wrong. You have to learn it fast and not doing it again. So yeah, think twice and read a lot opinions and see if you are the kind of person that want to go for that kind of path. I think it's that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, how long do you have to go till you get your PhD, till you get your designation?
So if everything goes well, as we planned in the beginning, 2 more years. So it's a 4 year, it's between 4 years and 5 years, the PhD in my university. You cannot take more than five. And you 4 and 5 was the, 4 is my plan as I'm working it. So 2 more years.
Do you, will you end up doing a thesis?
Yes, I'm already doing it. So it's 1 year of curricular, so courses, mm-hmm. academic courses, and then 3 years going for the thesis.
And what is your thesis on?
So it's very difficult to answer that question, but it's like this. So I see the stakeholder. I look at a stakeholder. So I really like strategy. And it's based on the cost benefit of each stakeholder to get and play the game. And the game in this case, it's to provide a digital healthcare service. So getting together to develop this kind of product or service and see what it takes, what are the thresholds between costs and benefits that each stakeholder perceives to provide this kind of service. So it's game theory, multi criteria analysis and stakeholder analysis. And you are like trying to play along. And it's very interesting because I get the chance to interview a lot of stakeholders and very different stakeholders from industry, from academics to even patients and caregivers. Because so my hypothesis is that patients don't adopt technology because they don't see the actual benefit from the technology. When they see it, they will accept, they will adopt. And one of the benefits is that your physician is in the game and wants to you to have the technology to adopt. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to test all these hypotheses. And if we get some point, you will know what are the drivers that make a patient accept a specific technology and provide and engage with the healthcare solution.
Well, I love that because that's that bridging you're talking about, isn't it? So
yeah.
I see you as a very passionate person, and I think that's amazing. And we're so lucky to have people like you that are working on these kinds of things because you're helping all of us globally. Do you realize that? Does that sink in with you at all, Salome?
I think it's the part when you become a mad person. There are some points in the week that you have to believe in that and you have to get to that because otherwise you would give up. But in our daily lives, you don't see that because you are just focused on getting there and getting to understand the system. And healthcare, it's so difficult. It's such a complex problem to solve that when you are there and you don't see a patient for a while, you totally forget that this is for people. So to be honest,
yeah.
You don't see that in your daily life. When you get a patient or you get to talk with a person outside of your world and you tell them what you do and you see their expression, that makes you happy because it's like, oh, cool. But daily life, you totally forget.
That's true, isn't it? We're stuck in the minutiae of it, not realizing the huge impact that someone like yourself can have. And I can tell you, just speaking personally, I'm just so grateful that there's people like you that are out there doing this kind of work, which I know, and I think we can all tell, is not an easy path that you've chosen, but it's a wonderful path that you've chosen. Is there anything before we wrap up that you would like to say or anything that you wanted to bring out today?
I would like to say that actually, because you are from Canada, and Canada, it's a very inspiring country in kind of healthcare for us. Even if we don't have the same system, we are not similar at all. But in my area of research and my area of work, Canada is always is presented as a very role model for a country that invests in technology and trying to make the best out of a community. And what I learned a lot reading from Canadian researcher, is that you bet a lot in the terms of community. So the healthcare for the community, and it's something that I really enjoy. So if people are listening from Canada and they like it in your country, it's one of my best pool of resources to explore, because you see people not as individuals, you see people as a community, and you try to build for smaller communities because you are such a huge country and makes it even more complex. But you have sometimes cities that are as big as our country, as my country, and you solve the problem by breaking it in small communities and trying to get the best of the community.
Yeah.
So that I like to have the opportunity to say that Canada, in that sense, has always marked me. It's Canada and Australia, but Canada, because it has a lot of very good examples of how to manage healthcare, and I really like it.
Yeah, I think that we're so lucky to have the healthcare system that we have, where it focuses on healthcare. And, you know, obviously any system has its challenges, but we know that when we're ill, we're going to be taken care of. And we also don't have to worry about getting a huge bill at the end of being taken care of too, because that weighs with people, right, as to what they're going to do about their healthcare if they know they're going to have to pay a fortune for it. And so I think we're really proud of that. I have to tell you, Salome, that London, Ontario is a very well-known healthcare center in our country. People come from all over to be part of the work here, either academically or patients or whatever. We're very blessed in this city to have such an incredible healthcare focus and environment. So listen, if you ever decide that you want to move to London, Ontario, Canada, and help us out with all that, I'll meet you at the airport, Salome.
I'll make you a visit for sure. That's for sure. No, but I hope so. And that's the problem of COVID. When I started the PhD, I had a huge planning of going to good places to learn more, because that's how you also get to know the people that are working in these places. Is they pass you knowledge that you will not get by reading it, or you have to watch them work and learn how to do it. And Canada was one of my places to go. And well, let's hope that coronavirus we get rid of it and we start flying and learning from each other again. So
yeah, well, I hope it's Canada that you choose to come to. So thank you so much for chatting with me today. It's been absolutely wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And to our listeners and our viewers, thank you for joining Salome and me today, and to hear about incredible people in the world that are doing such good things and working so hard for the rest of us. And I think that Salome is such a prime example of that. So to our listeners and viewers, though, thank you for joining us today. And please follow us on LinkedIn. And follow us on YouTube, and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, and until we meet again.